From the BBC World Service, this is News Desk, presented by Howard Philpott. The headlines. British government ministers have defended the decision to arrest Chile's former military leader, General Pinochet. Reports from Nigeria say more than 100 people were killed when a burst fuel pipe caught fire. Both President Clinton and Vice President Gore have joined the Middle East peace talks in an attempt to break the deadlock between Israelis and Palestinians. The Taiwanese envoy to mainland China has held face-to-face talks with the Chinese president, the first such meeting for almost 50 years. Also in this news desk, events in the Democratic Republic of Congo dominate an East African summit, and the opposition in Bangladesh stages a national strike to protest against the government's handling of the aftermath of the recent floods. British government ministers have defended the decision by police in London to arrest the former Chilean military leader General Augusto Pinochet. The Trade and Industry Secretary, Peter Mandelson, dismissed a protest by the Chilean government that the general had diplomatic immunity. Mr. Mandelson said the idea that a brutal dictator should have such immunity was repugnant. The Spanish authorities want to question General Pinochet about the murder of Spanish citizens during his rule. They have 40 days to request his extradition to Spain. Here's our legal affairs correspondent, Joshua Rosenberg.
Holding a diplomatic passport doesn't mean the holder is a diplomat. Some countries spread these passports widely among legislators and officials, while others are much more sparing. Although General Pinochet apparently did enter Britain on a diplomatic passport, that doesn't grant him immunity from prosecution, whatever the Chilean government may say. Immunity is reserved for accredited diplomats and members of foreign governments. I understand the Spanish authorities asked Scotland Yard to obtain a warrant for the general's arrest at the end of last week. The former dictator is accused of murdering Spanish citizens in Chile. That's considered to be an offence under Spanish law, even though the alleged killings did not take place in Spain. As the Home Office Minister Alan Michael explained, General Pinochet could have entered Britain for medical treatment on an ordinary Chilean passport.
He came in, as I understand it, on a passport which does not require a visa. There has been an application from the Spanish authorities, which the police and the magistrates have to act on. Within 40 days, the Spanish authorities have to give the detail of their application. At that point, the Home Secretary has to decide whether to allow the process to continue.
Extradition is a process which always involves both legal and political considerations. The Spanish government has some 2 weeks before it must present its evidence to the Home Secretary. Jack Straw must then decide whether the case should go ahead. There could then be a lengthy court battle, and General Pinochet won't be sent to Spain against his will unless the courts and the Home Secretary both give their approval. The general could apply for bail in the meantime, but he'd probably have to surrender his passport.
Joshua Rosenberg. An advance group from the European Security Organization, the OSCE, has arrived in Kosovo to prepare for the deployment of 2,000 international monitors. The force will verify the promised withdrawal of Serbian troops from the province. NATO surveillance planes have found evidence that some troops are being pulled out, but there's been more sporadic fighting in the province, with reports of attacks by Serb forces on ethnic Albanian villages. From the Kosovo capital, Pristina, Paul Wood reports.
As the OSCE monitors arrive in Kosovo, the prospect of NATO airstrikes against Yugoslavia is receding. Partly this is because the Yugoslav authorities do seem to be moving towards full compliance with UN resolutions. But refugees are still in the hills, and the leader of the OSCE advance party in Pristina, John Sandrock, says the monitors will move in with all possible speed.
We will bring as many people in as quickly as possible as the infrastructure and so on permit. I don't want to give you any numbers or any deadlines or any times, but we will respond to this issue as quickly as we can.
There is no ceasefire in Kosovo. There were more shooting incidents overnight, and three police officers were killed on Saturday, apparently in fighting with the rebel Kosovo Liberation Army. Mr. Sandrock was asked if the OSCE's presence could put a stop to the sporadic fighting.
Well, I would hope so. I haven't talked with the individuals concerned or anyone who is actually can give me any information on what's actually happened. But certainly, we hope that the overall presence of the OSCE can act in a stabilizing fashion, and hopefully, will resolve many of the issues.
The monitors face a complex task, ensuring their own security, giving the refugees confidence to go home, and assessing if Yugoslavia is really keeping its promises to the UN. but if Belgrade does not fully implement UN resolutions, it's recognised by Western officials that any future threat of air action will be restrained by fears that the 2,000 unarmed monitors might become 2,000 hostages.
That was Paul Wood in Pristina. Voting has ended in the first round of parliamentary elections in Macedonia, which borders Kosovo. About one quarter of the 2 million people in Macedonia are ethnic Albanians, and there's been international concern that tensions in Kosovo could spill across the border. But voting was reported to have been peaceful after a campaign dominated by issues of unemployment and the economy. The governing Social Democratic Alliance of the Prime Minister Branko Crvenkovski is being challenged by a centre-right opposition grouping. Correspondents say ethnic Albanian parties could hold the balance of power in the new parliament. Reports from eastern Nigeria say at least 100 people have been killed after a burst fuel pipeline caught fire. The accident occurred as local people were scooping up fuel from the broken pipeline near the town of Wari when it suddenly burst into flames. Up to 400 others received burns. Some reports suggest the pipeline caught fire when a bystander threw away a match he'd used to light a cigarette. Firefighters have been battling to put out the blaze. Correspondents say it's believed the pipeline leak, which began on Thursday, may have been due to sabotage. And at least 13 people have been killed and many more injured in Colombia by an oil pipeline explosion which set alight a nearby shantytown. The authorities suspect the pipeline may have been blown up by left-wing rebels who frequently targeted oil installations. The explosion happened in the middle of the night near the northwestern town of Segovia. About 70 people were being treated at a number of hospitals in the region. Here's our South America correspondent, Stephen Sveach.
The victims of this blast were residents of a small village which lies alongside the 800-kilometre-long Ostensa pipeline. Local police say the explosion sent oil pouring out in all directions, some of it landing on nearby houses. Soon, fire was spreading throughout the village. Rescue workers are at the scene, and the injured are being taken to hospitals, both in the surrounding area and in the nearest big city, Medellin. Doctors say many of the burns are severe, and the death toll could rise. In Colombia, sabotage at oil installations is usually associated with the country's second-largest guerrilla group, the National Liberation Army, or ELN. This year alone, the ELN is believed to have carried out more than 60 such attacks. However, the Ocensa pipeline, which pumps about 3,500 barrels a day from oil fields run by British Petroleum, has rarely been affected, and the authorities are remaining cautious, saying they do not yet know whether this explosion was caused by a bomb. If this does turn out to have been a guerrilla attack, it comes at a sensitive moment. Since he was elected earlier this year, President Andrés Pastrana has made rapid progress towards peace negotiations with both the ELN and with the much larger Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia. The ELN is due to hold further talks with government officials and representatives of civil society next year. But no ceasefire has been declared, and Mr. Pastrana also has his critics, who believe he is making too many concessions to the guerrillas. An explosion like this, involving heavy loss of civilian life, would make it harder for the president to argue his case.
Stephen Sveach. You're listening to Newsdesk in the BBC World Service. The presidents of Kenya, Uganda and Tanzania have called for an immediate ceasefire in the Democratic Republic of Congo and the withdrawal of all foreign troops from the country. At the end of a summit in Nairobi, they also appealed for the deployment of an international peacekeeping force, saying the conflict in Congo threatened the security of the whole region. Uganda, along with Rwanda, is accused by Kinshasa of supporting rebels fighting to overthrow the government of President Laurent Kabila. Here's our East Africa correspondent, Kathy Jenkins.
A statement issued after 3 hours of talks stressed concern at the escalation of the conflict in the Democratic Republic of Congo and the implications for the security of the region. The three countries called, among other things, for an immediate cessation of hostilities, an orderly withdrawal of foreign troops, and for an international peacekeeping force. The statement didn't indicate which country should participate in a neutral force or if any plans had already been drawn up. The leaders also called for the security concerns of neighbouring countries to be addressed. Uganda, for example, has admitted having troops inside the Democratic Republic of Congo, but maintains they are there to confront rebels who are fighting to oust President Museveni. The summit at State House in Nairobi came 1 week after rebels battling President Kabila won control of the strategically important town of Kindu. Following the setback for the government, President Kabila's ally, President Mugabe of Zimbabwe, gave an assurance that he would continue to support President Kabila militarily. President Kabila has so far refused to hold talks with the rebels. He says they are puppets of Uganda and Rwanda. He accuses the two countries who helped put him in power of invading the Democratic Republic of Congo. Officials at State House were quoted as saying it had been hoped that President Kabila would attend the summit, but he didn't turn up.
Kathy Jenkins in Nairobi. President Clinton has gone to the American state of Maryland to see if he can advance the Middle East peace talks, which are now in their fourth day. Mr. Clinton, who's accompanied by his Vice President Al Gore, had separate meetings on Saturday with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. American officials still say they're hoping agreement on an interim peace package will be achieved by the end of the day, but serious differences appear to remain. Our correspondent Stephen Sacker reports.
President Clinton is employing all of his persuasive powers in an effort to bridge the gaps between the Israeli and Palestinian delegations. Security issues represent the main obstacle to an agreement. The Israelis say their withdrawal from a further 13% of the West Bank is contingent upon a package of Palestinian measures against Islamic militants in the West Bank and Gaza. On a range of specific points, from the extradition of wanted militants to Israel to the confiscation of weapons, Mr. Arafat's assurances have yet to satisfy the Israelis. This morning, Prime Minister Netanyahu convened a meeting of his security cabinet at the Y Conference Center before meeting President Clinton. For their part, the Palestinians are insisting that any agreement must include an Israeli commitment to another pullback from the West Bank to precede any final peace agreement. Thus far, the Israelis have rejected that demand. U.S. officials still say they're working towards an agreement by the end of Sunday, but that deadline may become unrealistic.
Stephen Sacker in Washington. Archaeologists in Israel have discovered about 300 ancient gold coins on an excavation site in the north of the country. The coins were contained in a 6th century ceramic pot buried under the walls of a Roman city. Recent digging indicates that the site was a wealthy city in the Byzantine era. A senior Taiwanese envoy, Gu Chunfu, has held what's seen as a historic meeting with the Chinese president, Jiang Zemin, the highest-level official talks between the two sides since the end of the Civil War nearly 50 years ago. Mr. Gu described the talks as very pleasant, despite China's continued rejection of Taiwan as an independent state. Duncan Hewitt reports from Beijing.
Political sensitivities mean that the meeting between Gu Zhenfu and President Jiang Zemin was described as a courtesy call by China's official news agency. But it said the atmosphere was cordial, and the 81-year-old Taiwanese envoy, who has encountered Mr. Jiang before in international gatherings, said he felt as though he were meeting an old friend. He said they had a frank and sincere exchange of views. Both praised last week's agreement to increase exchanges between lower-level negotiators. And Mr. Gu said his visit had been an important first step in reviving dialogue. But differences are clear. Gu Zhenfu said he had raised with President Jiang the question of democratization, which Taiwan says is a prerequisite for reunification. Earlier, in a meeting with China's Deputy Prime Minister Chen Qichun, he stressed that without international diplomatic space, Taiwan could not contemplate the political negotiations on reunification which China seeks. And he called on Beijing to accept the existence of the Republic of China, Taiwan's formal name, as an equal sovereign state. Such ideas are rejected by Beijing, whose spokesman Tang Shubei said Taiwan should face reality. Gu Zhenfu said neither side should be afraid of expressing its differences, but he stressed that mutual understanding would require a great number of contacts. For the moment, China's leaders appear ready to accept a gradual approach, but it remains to be seen how long their patience will last. And China continues to press for the rapid opening of direct trade and transport links, which Taiwan still maintains would put its security at risk.
Duncan Hewitt in Beijing. At least 90 pilot whales have died after being stranded on a beach on the Australian island of Tasmania. Volunteers who joined an all-day rescue operation saved about 30 whales by loading them onto trucks and taking them to deeper water. A BBC correspondent says the operation proved particularly frustrating as some whales tried to turn back to the beach as soon as they were released. You're listening to Newsdesk from the BBC in London. Time now for a reminder of the day's top headline. British government ministers have defended the decision to arrest Chile's former military leader, General Pinochet. And still to come in the programme, how two of America's top golfers fought out the last major tournament of the year on the final hole. The main opposition party in Bangladesh says 200 of its supporters were arrested during a general strike in the capital, Dhaka. The strike was called after the authorities banned a rally against the government's alleged incompetence in handling the aftermath of the recent devastating floods. From Dhaka, David Chazan reports.
Rival groups of opposition and government supporters held small demonstrations, blocking several streets with burning tyres. Some young men ignored them and played cricket or football, taking advantage of the absence of cars from Dakar's normally congested streets. A number of demonstrators were hurt in scuffles with police. After the dawn-to-dusk strike, leaders of the opposition Bangladesh National Party said 200 of their supporters had been arrested. Police, however, said they'd made only 64 arrests. They also denied the party's claim that two of its supporters had been killed, one by the police and another by pro-government demonstrators. The England and Zimbabwe cricket teams arriving for an international tournament had to be driven to their hotels under armed escort. Many Bangladeshis fear that could harm the national image. Despite a government appeal for a halt to political demonstrations while the country struggles to repair the widespread damage caused by the floods, the opposition has now called another general strike for Thursday, this time for only half a day, but for the whole country, not just the capital. The opposition accuses the government of failing to provide food and shelter for the millions whose homes, crops and livestock were wiped out by the floods. Opposition leaders are also angry about the recent arrests of three opposition members of parliament, who've been charged with murdering four politicians in 1975. In the aftermath of the floods, which the United Nations says will leave millions of Bangladeshis dependent on foreign food aid well into next year, neither the governing nor opposition parties seem willing to shelve their differences and work together to put the country back on its feet.
David Chazan in Dhaka. Violent weather conditions have claimed at least 12 lives in Japan as Typhoon Zeb swept across the country. Police say over 1,000 people have been evacuated from areas threatened by rising water levels. Typhoon Zeb has already caused more than 90 deaths and extensive damage in the Philippines and Taiwan. Off the west coast of India, a search and rescue operation is continuing for fishermen reported missing after a cyclonic storm. The Indian news agency PTI says that of some 250 men missing, about 200 are now believed to have returned home safely. The foreign ministers of India and Pakistan have concluded talks in the Pakistani capital, Islamabad, the first since both countries carried out nuclear tests in May. The meeting, which began on Friday, was also dominated by the most contentious issue dividing them, the disputed territory of Jammu and Kashmir. A final communique said the two countries had agreed to meet again in India next year. But as Owen Bennett-Jones reports from Islamabad, while they say they're committed to the dialogue process, no specific agreements have been reached so far.
The foreign secretaries discussed two items, confidence-building measures and Kashmir. The day devoted to Kashmir produced little more than a reiteration of long-held and incompatible positions. Pakistan says Kashmir is the root cause of the problems between the two countries, and the Pakistani Foreign Secretary said that without resolution of the Kashmir dispute, it's difficult to see how substantive progress can be made in other areas. His Indian counterpart, by contrast, said it would be more productive to start with small issues and then move on to the more substantial and complex areas of disagreement. The part of the talks devoted to confidence-building measures also failed to produce much progress. Both India and Pakistan made proposals on how to manage their nuclear capability. But there wasn't even agreement on apparently uncontroversial proposals like developing secure and fail-safe communications links for the two sides' military and political leaderships. The two countries say they'll study these issues and talk about them again in February. Officials say they never went into these talks with inflated hopes, and it's difficult to escape the conclusion that their low expectations have been comprehensively fulfilled.
Owen Bennett-Jones in Islamabad. The Taliban militia in Afghanistan have launched an attack on positions held by troops loyal to the opposition commander, Ahmad Shah Massoud, north of the capital, Kabul. An opposition spokesman said the militia had made initial gains, but had later been repulsed. William Reeve reports from Kabul that if the Taliban advance is successful, it'll put them within striking distance of the opposition's main airbase.
For the past week, the Taliban have been attacking on several fronts in attempted pincer movements against opposition positions not far north of Kabul. One of these assaults along the Qurban Valley is from the west. Another, coming from the east, is through the district of Nejrao. While there's been little movement along the Qurban Valley, there do seem to have been limited gains by the Taliban around Nejrao. The significance of a Taliban advance here is that it would put them within striking distance of the opposition's main airbase at Bagram. The opposition say the fighting around Nejrao on Sunday has been the heaviest so far, and they concede that the Taliban have made gains. An opposition spokesman said the Taliban advanced beyond Solanak Pass, after which there's open ground to Bagram. But he said the Taliban were then beaten back, with many killed in the retreat. He said Taliban jets also bombed the town of Chari Khar in the fertile Shumali Valley that stretches north from Kabul. During Sunday, the opposition launched three rockets on the capital. Two hit the airport with no reports of casualties, but the third landed on a civilian area in the east of the city and killed at least three people. In a separate development, the UN Special Representative to Afghanistan, Lakhdar Brahimi, says he's due to fly to Tehran on Tuesday to discuss setting up direct talks between the Taliban and Iran.
William Reeve in Kabul. Voters in the Central Asian Republic of Kyrgyzstan have overwhelmingly approved several constitutional amendments in a referendum, including measures to privatize land. Election officials said more than 90% of voters had backed the reforms. President Asghar Akayev called Saturday's vote to force through the measures that were being blocked by Parliament. The Kyrgyz authorities say there will be at least a five-year moratorium on land sales after privatization, and foreign nationals will not be allowed to own land. A BBC correspondent says the result is a vote of confidence in Mr. Akayev, who said land reform would help create a middle class in Kyrgyzstan. President Haidar Aliyev of Azerbaijan has said he'll draw on his international political experience to improve relations with opposition parties. He was speaking at a ceremony to inaugurate him in his second term as president, following his re-election a week ago. Among the guests was the Russian Foreign Minister Igor Ivanov, who later met President Aliyev. Mr. Ivanov said that Russia was committed to a peaceful solution to the conflict in the Armenian-inhabited enclave of Nagorno-Karabakh, which is part of Azerbaijan. Stephen Mulvey reports from the Azerbaijani capital, Baku.
After taking an oath on the Quran, Mr. Aliyev went down unsteadily on one knee and kissed the flag of Azerbaijan. The guests of honour were indicative of the carefully balanced foreign policy he pursued in his first five-year term. Among them, the Russian Foreign Minister Igor Ivanov and a special representative of the US administration, Yan Kalitsky. Sitting alongside them were the president of the rebellious Russian Republic of Chechnya, Aslan Maskhadov, and dignitaries from neighbouring Georgia. Mr. Aliyev's speech included an unprecedented overture to his political opponents. He said that he understood that democracy was impossible without an opposition and that he wanted to raise his relations with them to a higher and healthier level. He added that he was ready for any talks that would help the two sides achieve greater understanding. These words come after bitter criticism of last week's election, both from the radical opposition, which boycotted the vote, and the moderate opposition leader, Etibar Mamedov, who came second. Both branches of the opposition have claimed that Mr. Aliyev's victory was the result of fraud, and pledged a campaign of demonstrations aimed at unseating him. It's a prospect Mr. Aliyev clearly wishes to avoid, but this olive branch is likely to have come too late to have any effect.
Stephen Mulvey in Baku. In Russia in the past week, there have been renewed calls for President Boris Yeltsin to stand down. The calls came after Mr. Yeltsin was unable to complete a visit to Central Asia because of ill health. Even long-time supporters of the president, such as the mayor of Moscow, Yuri Lushkov, are now beginning to ask whether Mr. Yeltsin should not resign. But there are strong reasons why the Russian president will not go easily. Our Russian affairs analyst, Stephen Diel, looks at the options.
If power is an aphrodisiac, then Boris Yeltsin has been on a seven-year high and doesn't want to come down now. The notion that the Russian president wants to rule for the good of his people died long ago. Mr. Yeltsin now wants power for its own sake. He also does not wish to be the first Russian or Soviet leader to retire gracefully. All but two Soviet leaders died in office. The exceptions were Nikita Khrushchev and Mikhail Gorbachev. Mr. Khrushchev was removed in 1964 in what was effectively a palace coup. And Mr. Gorbachev was forced to stand down at the end of 1991 because the country of which he was president, the Soviet Union, ceased to exist. Mr. Yeltsin is also paying homage to a certain Russian machismo. To step down, according to this idea, would be to demonstrate weakness. Never mind that it may be in the country's interest, Mr. Yeltsin does not wish to appear weak before his citizens. The Russian leader also fears retribution. The country is still so volatile that Mr. Yeltsin fears that, should his opponents gain power, they could try to blame him for the shortcomings of the last 7 years. The minimum which Mr. Yeltsin would require before even beginning to contemplate an honourable resignation would be a cast-iron guarantee that his past would not be allowed to come back to haunt him.
Stephen D.L. Tens of thousands of people have attended Mass in St. Peter's Square in Rome at the end of week-long celebrations to mark the 20th anniversary of Pope John Paul's election to the leadership of the Catholic Church. The Pope thanked all those who'd supported him during his time in office and asked for their prayers in the future. Among the guests was the Italian President Oscar Luigi Scalfaro. You're listening to Newsdesk in the BBC World Service. The time is just past 18:26 Greenwich Mean Time, and we move on to sport. And one of the world's top golfers has crowned a magnificent season by winning yet another prestigious event. Gordon Eastwood reports on this and the rest of the sports news.
The American Marco Mira had already taken the Masters and the Open title in Britain before starting the World Match Play at Wentworth in southern England. Although not one of the sport's majors, it's an event in which every leading golfer wants to appear, not least because the top prize is worth almost $300,000. And as Russell Fuller reports, Mira's opponent, Tiger Woods, ensured he earned every cent.
A wonderful climax to a wonderful week. The outstanding golfer of 1998 beating the world number one on the 36th and final green. Marco Mira's 18-foot putt for victory completed an afternoon round of 8 under par 64 and helped him turn a three-hole lunchtime deficit into a one-hole victory. Tiger Woods will be wondering how he lost. He made 7 birdies in the morning and another 7 in the afternoon. But when the match was all square with 3 holes remaining, he took 3 putts from 6 foot on the 16th green and lost a hole he looked like winning. Woods and O'Meara are close friends and play together regularly. There's often $30 at stake, a far cry from this week's $275,000 first prize.
The second cricket test between Pakistan and Australia in Peshawar is heading for a draw. At close of play on the fourth day, Australia were 21 without loss in their second innings. That's a lead of 40 runs. And finally, the former world heavyweight boxing champion Mike Tyson will soon find out whether he'll be allowed to fight again. The Nevada State Athletic Commission meets on Monday to decide whether to return his license. Tyson was banned after biting Evander Holyfield's ears during a world title bout last year.
The sport with Gordon Eastwood. Now to end News Desk, a reminder of the main stories. British government ministers have been defending the arrest of the former Chilean military leader, General Pinochet, at a London clinic. The Trade and Industry Secretary, Peter Mandelson, described him as a brutal dictator and dismissed a protest by the Chilean government that the general had diplomatic immunity. The Home Office Minister, Alan Michael, said the general's passport did not guarantee diplomatic immunity. At least 100 people have been killed in southeastern Nigeria after a burst fuel pipeline caught fire. The incident occurred as local people were scooping up fuel from the pipeline. Both President Clinton and Vice President Al Gore have joined the Middle East peace talks in an attempt to ensure a deal. They hope to secure agreement for Israel's withdrawal from more of the West Bank in exchange for security guarantees from the Palestinians. And the Taiwanese envoy, Gu Chunfu, has held an historic meeting with the Chinese President Jiang Zemin, the highest level official talks between the two sides for nearly 50 years. Those were the headlines. For the last half hour, you've been listening to News Desk, which came to you in the World Service of the BBC.